Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBRU program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Leland de la Durantaye, author of the new novel Hannah vs. the Tree from McSweeney's Press. Leland is a critic, translator, and professor of comparative literature at the Claremont Colleges. His journalism and criticism have appeared in the New York Times, the London Review of Books, Book Forum, Art Forum, and The Believer. Leland's translation of the Jacques Jouet novel Upstaged was a finalist for the 2012 Penn Best Translated Book Award. Hannah vs. the Tree is Leland's first novel. In the words of literary critic James Wood, Hannah vs. the Tree is unlike anything I have ever read, thriller, myth, dream, and poem combined. And Amy Hempel writes, betrayal and vengeance have rarely been so elegantly rendered as in this searing novel. Leland de la Durantaye, welcome to KBRU.
Thank you.
Leland, as mentioned, you're a professor of comparative literature at the Claremont Colleges and previous to that at Harvard. In the role of scholar, you've written essays, literary criticism, and translated fiction from French and Italian authors. How did you go from that to writing your first book of fiction?
That's an excellent question. I ask it of myself. But the answer is that it isn't that I've begun something that I hadn't been doing before. It's that I've completed something that I'd been trying to do the whole time. I love to translate. I love critical work. I love philological and philosophical analysis. And I love teaching it. And I was really satisfied in writing about writers that are dear to me, like Nabokov or Beckett, or philosophers who are important to me, such as Giorgio Agamben, who's the most important influence in my life intellectually. And that was my job. But I got that job so as to be able to write fiction. And over the years that I was writing critical essays and books and translating essays and books, I was writing fiction. But I could never make one cohere. I could never complete one. About a decade ago, I'd been writing a book that was called Analyst, Architect, Accident. And it was quite far along, so far along that my agent had gotten an offer for it. And I realized that I couldn't accept it. I couldn't finish it. The flaw in its core was just really too insidious. I could see that I couldn't make it complete and whole. And so I had to abandon it. Hannah represents two things for me. One is what happened when I was given a year sabbatical and no longer needed to do anything to have job security. I had a job security and I was made a full professor, so I wasn't going to be reviewed anymore. And I had to ask myself what I was going to do if it was, or what I would write when it was simply up to me. And Hannah is what ensued. I'm sorry to go on at such length in the answer, but there's one other half of it, which is that for some reason, I was able to complete this book. And so I've been trying to do this my whole life. I'm 46. I've been trying to write this since I was about 4.
It must have been a great feeling then when you finished the manuscript.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember the moment when I realized when I finished it. The last words had existed for a while in my drafts, and I hadn't realized that they would be the end or what would precede them to make them the end. But the moment when I finished, when I knew it was finished, it was a huge relief, a huge pleasure.
We talked before the interview about the interview you did with Michael Silverblatt for Bookworm, which I listened to and loved. He called the book perfect, and it was interesting that you interpreted perfection as completion. I guess,
exactly.
Somewhat humbly, it's hard to call your own work perfect, I guess, but Michael did.
It is hugely flattering, and of course, the only sane way to respond to such a compliment is through some form of modesty. And I do feel very humbled and honored by him finding it. So for any reader to find it really complete, let alone in some sense perfect, which is, it's human, it's very imperfect. But if it's satisfying in some deep way for someone, and that has to do with their sense of its completion, its being round and whole as a thing, as a story, well, then that's a huge pleasure. That's a huge honor. And so it wasn't just modesty that made me respond in that manner. That's what I see as singular about it. It is relatively complete. It's a completed action for me.
And we'll get into the perfection of the book, certainly some of the aspects that I think Michael saw in it. Now, it's narrated by a lifelong friend of the title character and lover of Hannah. Her full name is Hannah Silk Silva Searle. That's the title character. The narrator is unnamed. He's telling the story to Hannah's grandmother, who's also unnamed, as part of a legal agreement. A very effective way of telling the story. How did you choose this method?
It chose me, I suppose, in that I'd written a lot of the book. I'd written a lot of the material that became the final product before it was in the second person, or before it was exclusively in the second person. And so as I was sketching the novel, as I was developing the material, sometimes it would be in the third person and sometimes it would be in the second person. And that idea grew very gradually through the individual sentences of it, such that the book came to be in the second person, and then there was the question, to whom is it addressed? And eventually it was to be addressed to the matriarch of this powerful family, the defeated party. So that I realized formally quite late, but once I did, it made sense to me. What I want is to address the reader. I want to compel you. I want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to my story. And that's the tone of the book's voice. It is, it's a lyrical voice in the sense it's written in love, and it has a demand in it to be heard, or it wants to tell its story. And I realized then that it could have only ever been written in the second person, but I only knew that quite late.
Now the fact that you chose a secondary character to be the narrator rather than Hannah herself reminded me a little of The Great Gatsby, which is narrated by Nick Carraway, definitely a secondary character. I think the effect there, among others, is it makes Jay Gatsby, the title character, seem more like a romantic hero. We're told of his rise and fall in the book. Was that part of your reason to have a narrator other than the main character? I mean, in addition to the fact that it's in the second person.
Yeah, great question. So one side of it is that genius doesn't find itself particularly extraordinary. It isn't shocked by its capacity in the way that someone who's quite near genius, near Hannibal, near Einstein, near Julius Caesar, near someone astounding in mind. They can chronicle it. They could note that Julius Caesar would write three letters at once, or he would dictate three letters at once and write a fourth one at the same time. He could never narrate that without sounding insufferable, without sounding impossible. Hannah telling her story would tell her story, but she wouldn't talk about the extraordinary element, which was her, the things that she could do. So I needed to have a character who could really see her and who'd seen her the whole time, who could confront the mystery of her greatness or her genius, which is to say he saw her from the very beginning. He can calculate the nature or the nurture in her capacity. And he can attest, because he's known her in childhood and he's known her in adulthood, he's her lover, what the greatness of what she's doing, or how astounding it is that she's been able to do the series of things that she can do. So I think when you want to have an epic in the literary sense, which is a story of a hero, you often need a perspective of someone who's not that, but who can really see it and appreciate it.
And that's what our unnamed narrator does here. I was just thinking that there are occasionally people who refer to themselves as stable geniuses, but I guess that's they're not really geniuses at all. Now, you mentioned epic there. The novel's a relatively short one, about 170 pages, concise, lyrical, reads somewhat like an epic poem to me, like Homer or Virgil. These epic poems, the fact that you even mentioned epic, must have been a strong influence on Hannah.
Absolutely. What I realize is that when I compose, I am composing speeches, and they're not in their length unlike a book of a classical poem or a session or a setting of a very long story. Hannah, however, is is meant to be compulsively read, or it has, as we were talking about, it's in the second person. It's really trying hard to compel the reader, but it is speaking in a certain distance way of great acts, and those great acts are spoken of with very carefully chosen language, very measured language.
Well, we were talking about language, but that interests me also about the epic. The subject is the hero. And Hannah, of course, is a hero, a heroine in this book, like Odysseus in Homer's Odyssey, Aeneas in Virgil's epic. You also mention in the book, name check, Alexander the Great. Hannibal's in there too. And Hannah is somewhat similar to them. She's a contemporary hero. What attracted you to have Hannah follow in the path of these mythical and historical heroes?
Place of composition is probably the best answer. But it could also be childish or childhood predilection, which is to say, as a child, I loved the story of heroes, great stories. I love the stories of Julius Caesar, and I've always really deeply loved the Odyssey. Perhaps the novel that I've loved lots of novels in my life, but perhaps the novel I love most right now is Ulysses. And one of the things that's so incredibly beautiful about it is it as a rereading of the story of Odysseus, imagining what's really significant about Odysseus. What is his character? And one of the things that Joyce really beautifully stresses is his resilience, his equanimity, the readiness and the speed with which he accepts the given situation. And so Hannah's genius is a little bit like Odysseus's in that she's a little bit faster. If there's one way to sort of boil down what her genius consists, she's very physically able. She's very mentally prompt. She is brilliant in lots of ways. But the way that's most distinctive is Odysseus's way. She somehow sees the angles of everyone's outcomes. She somehow sees a little bit more quickly the shape that the situation is taking. And so that gives her, in situations of conflict, a huge strategic advantage. She knows more quicker. And so she does something basically that Julius Caesar would do, or to a certain extent Hannibal, or any great general, which is make the conflict about real-time decisions. Who can make good decisions fast? A kind of speed chess of strategy. And Caesar was really great, and so was Hannibal, at forcing their opponent to think faster than they're comfortable doing, forcing their error. And so there's a real relentlessness with which Hannah forces her adversary's errors by speed and by the unpredictable nature of her genius. That's the great thing about Odysseus. His genius is so unpredictable.
I want to get a little bit more into the language too, Leland. These are epic poems that kind of gave birth to Hannah, or at least were influences on it. First, I'd like to give listeners a taste of that. I wondered if you would be kind enough to read a passage for us.
Happily. If you come in from the cold of the north, from the snows of the upper peninsula, nothing but snow and bears and wolves and wind and ice and cold water, and you are in a cabin before a roaring fire, and you begin to warm yourself, and the numbness starts to give way to tingling and feeling, and you drink something warm and the heat returns, and you lie by the fire, too warm to move, and fall asleep. And you wake, and it is night, and now there's no more fire, and no more cabin, only huge starry darkness. And it is snowing, and you are alone with the bears and the wolves, and the cold is final and is coming, ever more of it. It was like that.
Oh, I love that. A very sensual passage, and just beautiful, the rhythm of it. One very long poetic sentence followed by a fairly short declarative one. It's a good mix there.
Thank you.
It seems like a very difficult style, though, to get right. How did you go about? Were there a lot of kind of false starts there, or how'd you arrive at that voice?
Absolutely wonderful question. Finding the voice was in a certain sense completing the book, and that I'd been trying to write the voice all year. The book is relatively short, and if I sat down to write it, I could have written it in, you know, I don't know how long, but maybe even as short as 10 days if it was sort of all in mind. But I wrote it over the course of a year, and I was constantly, in my mind, I was usually using the metaphor of sketching, but when I would sit down for any given writing session in Rome, So I wrote the whole thing in Rome. I would sketch for a while. That was a very ready model to have in mind because I'd seen or was seeing so much visual art in Rome. Rome is so full of visual art. But I was sketching and sketching, seeking the tone, the tone that would be lyrical, because it's spoken in the key of love. It's spoken in the language of love. The person who speaks is intensely, ardently in love with the person he's telling the story with Hannah. But he's not talking to her, and he's not talking to a disinterested third party. He's talking in a really passionate and in some respects angry tone, vindicated and vindictive, because he's pointing out the extent of Hannah's adversary's defeat. He's showing her what was done to her, and that she herself is only just realizing at that moment. And so he has a huge amount of schadenfreude. He has a huge amount of pleasure, because he knows he loves Hannah, and he knows he's seen that she was wronged. And so he takes a huge pleasure and huge pleasure in the vengeance of that. And so finding that tone was finding the book. It's the tone came with the content, and I was constantly tweaking it.
You'd have to get inside his head, which I think you did. All those feelings going on, that joy, but also that vengeance, that sense of revenge and schadenfreude, as you mentioned.
And also the way that it happened, I could tell a completely different and equally accurate story of that by saying, I was writing sentences every day, and most of them I would throw away. But each day, there would be a few that I could save. And as the year went on, I had more and more of them. And so I began to fit them together, the good parts, harmonize them. And they made the voice, or they together, those me trying to write good sentences, certain kind of rhythmic formations that would be rhythms of love and rhythms of vengeance. And so it came in a certain sense through the sentences.
Now, you mentioned Joyce's Ulysses. That's currently your favorite novel.
I have a lot of loves, and Lolita is a book that I wrote a book about Nabokov called Styles Matter, but it's mostly about Lolita, and Lolita really broke my heart. It was incredibly beautiful as a book, and when I was young. That was in a book that maybe I had the most love for certain things that had shown me, for a shade of its beauty. But now in this phase, I've been teaching Ulysses this semester to my students, and I taught it last year as well. And the more I look into it, the more beautiful its construction is, and the more joyous its attitude to life. It's a really extremely loving and funny affirmation of the world with all its flaws and betrayals and absurdities. And so right now I do feel the most love from there.
And your book, in fact, has been compared to Ulysses. I've read reviews where it's been called Joycean. And I think one reason is the obvious reference to the Odyssey, the hero's journey, but also to the literal language. However, the vocabulary is simpler than Joyce's in here. He even makes up a lot of different words. It's almost as if it's being translated from another language, your book, like French or Italian or maybe Greek or Latin. I read years ago that Hemingway arrived at his style by writing as if his sentences were translated from what would be written in the French. Was that something you were doing consciously?
No, but the effect of foreign language on the composition of the book was huge, which is to say, the year that I was writing it, I spoke very little English. I would see Agamben, this master of mine. I was for a while dating an Italian woman. I have a really dear old friend, Fabio Benincasa, who's been my friend for 18 years and who I've seen in all over the world at different points. But spending a lot of time with close Italian friends. And so as a result, my entire day was in Italian for almost the entire year. And when I was getting to be in English was when I was writing Hannah. And so I wasn't, it doesn't surprise me that you say what you say about the translated tone of it. It wasn't that I was necessarily translating it, but switching between the languages and not using your writing language as your everyday language does pare it down, does a lot of habitual idiomatic usages, a lot of idioms, a lot of idioms.
Well, that reminds me a little of Beckett, who you mentioned earlier, who was a native English speaker, he's Irish, but he wrote in French.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, however, blows my mind. That is to say, I can... I used to have Beckett's job in Paris, and when I had Beckett's job in Paris at the École Normale Supérieure, which is a lecteur, a reader, I suppose I had his level. I don't say that in a boastful way, but I've studied French for a long time and lived in France for a long time, and so it's a language, and I've written a little bit in it. I could never imagine using it as an expressive medium, and so it just makes it more all the more astounding that Beckett did what he did, which is to write so beautifully and so wildly, so freely in a foreign language. It's amazing. But so going Beckett's way, away from the mother tongue into another, I couldn't. But I'm sure that
Joseph Conrad's another example, who was Polish and wrote in English. And I think both of those examples, that's pretty much what contributed to their unique styles.
Yeah. You know, absolutely. There's an interesting difference, and that's maybe why I have a particular fascination for Beckett, in that Conrad knew the languages. You know, he knew French and he knew English and he knew Polish when he was really young. Nabokov knew English, Russian, and French as a small child. Beckett learned his literary language as in late adolescent or as an adult. And to so appropriate something foreign is an amazing thing.
At that stage.
And, and to do such a wild thing with it. But the effect of foreign language on me has been intense, in that simply the activity of translating from Italian and French, and a little bit, I translate from German a little bit. And so the effect of contemplating those different syntactic structures so as to render them in one's own language, I think definitely has an effect on the language.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. On today's show, we're talking with Leland de la Durantaye, author of the new novel Hannah Versus the Tree from McSweeney's Press. Now let's talk about the story of Hannah and also the main character. Hannah's from a very wealthy family, a dynasty of sorts, the Searles. I looked up the name and found a reference to a character in the computer game War of Warcraft, and the character was described as Vengeance Incarnate. I couldn't help but think, did you have that in mind, or is that just a happy coincidence?
That's a happy coincidence. I've never heard of that. I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Is there another origin of Searle then? Is that just a name you kind of were attracted to and thought it fit the character and the family?
It just fit. The truth is it's color in part. I've colored audition. I hear letters with colors, and I really needed their name to be a certain color. Or for me emotionally, it was important that the name, even though it was just a working name, feel right and have a certain glint, have a certain color.
What's the color then of Searle?
It's a kind of dusky silver. It's a kind of it has a kind of tinge of blue, very subtle, and it's gray. It has a very little bit of blue, but it's bright and it's fierce. It's very streamlined and Nordic, because they're Vikings on the mythic level. They're Vikings. She's from a Viking family. They're modern Vikings. They raid differently. They raid minerals and from the Amazon.
That's where the wealth comes from, and that's a big part of the plot too. Is a scheme that Hannah opposes, and some bad things happen from there ensue.
Yeah, but in theory, though, this would just be implicit in the way that they're discussed by the people who discuss them. They've always been that way. Mm-hmm. They're an aristocratic family in an aristocratic world where being a raider is part of the identity. The identity of you know, old Vikings was that they were raiders, you know.
I thought of some more modern families when I was reading about the Searles, particularly the Koch brothers, Koch Industries, even the Trumps for that matter. And I kept imagining Hannah's vengeance on the Searles is something like the little-known Trump daughter Tiffany might do to her corrupt family.
Wow.
If only. But you started writing Hannah before Trump became president, right? And did you have any other antecedents to the Searle family in mind, other than, you know, what I came up with, the Kochs and the Trumps?
No, I didn't have any modern family in mind. I had no single family in mind. In a way, I had the mythic outline of a powerful family where there isn't a significant moral difference between being an old aristocratic family wielding power in that way and being a modern robber baron or commercial capital family in the basic ethic within the family, or as concerns the inner ethic of those families. It's pretty much the same. The political situation was a different one than now. When I was writing it, my mom is an old Bernie Sanders supporter from Senate races, and she's a hippie. My parents are hippies. They met, as activists against the Vietnam War, and so I grew up in a world where fortunes themselves, capitalist enterprises themselves, are criminal essentially.
Right.
Not easily morally defensible. A corporation is not morally defensible. I'm not saying that per se now
this
as
is
an
your,
adult.
Your
but,
parents' views.
But yeah, the view that my parents had me when they were very young, that I had growing up of economic violence, and so I suppose I'm just reflecting my upbringing or my ratification of that upbringing, or that obviously wealth above a certain scale is violence. There's a certain level of wealth which is inherently violent. Whether to make a moral judgment about that is a separate matter. But in the book, Hannah's vengeance is personal, but it's in her line of the family, a family tradition to resist the family. Her father had resisted the family and had been disinherited and dies when she's quite young. And so one thing she's doing is carrying through his dream, which is to limit the violence of their family. And something that within the family is considered treason within that family, as within lots of powerful families, aristocratic families. Betraying the family is immoral, no matter what immoral act the family commits. It's betraying a family member is even a distant family member, so long as they bear your name and are a representative of your greatness, is a huge sin. And there's a huge resistance to punishing wrongdoing in powerful families because of the negative publicity that it brings. And so that's definitely a strong element in the story.
And there was some punishment brought down on Hannah, which kind of drives a lot of the plot, so I won't mention that. There was one, you have an interview on the McSweeney site, and there was one line there that I think has something to do with this question. You said, "But if there is any real reason why I wrote what I did, it was not to denounce social ills or to present political hypocrisies, but to write of love." So you had kind of a higher calling in producing this book and writing this book.
Absolutely. I had no political intention. Oh, and the thing, I'm sorry, I was in the middle. I should complete the earlier thought, which is just to say, so my mom is an old Sanders supporter. I was in Rome writing, and I knew about the possibility of Sanders through her. The Italian press wasn't writing about it very much, and they weren't especially interested in Trump, or they just thought Trump was like Berlusconi, which is, you know, a real estate developer who's handsy and crapulent, but we've seen it before. Lots of the Italian press had been saying, this is like Berlusconi, he seems impossible, and then he just ends up being a kind of criminal, unsurprising, kleptocratic leader, and then you get rid of him. And so they didn't see that this is the press wasn't seeing Trump as a real danger and real factor, because when I was writing the book, it was before the election. I finished it in the spring, and so that's just as Trump was winning the nomination and Sanders was losing the nomination. But those things were really remote from me at the time. The book was really complete before the current political shape.
I can tell you in America, the press it was very similar. A lot of us did not take Trump seriously, or thought he had any chance of winning. So the Italians really weren't that far off. Now, the another interview in McSweeney's in that that same website, it was a really interesting one. You mentioned how prevalent the theme of revenge is in art, and vengeance is a big part of Hannah versus the Tree. It drives the narrative. You call vengeance or revenge the driving force in Western literary history, but a bad idea in real life. And you go back to a reason why it's a bad idea, because revenge is really the purview of the state now, of the people in power. It didn't used to be. You mentioned early Christianity spoke out against things like that, probably in response to the Old Testament, which is very much about revenge. But of course, Christianity and most religions are not allowed that now. Can you tell us a little bit more about your view on that revenge and vengeance in real life versus art and literature?
Yeah, thank you. Interesting question. Such a big question for me. So one thing about the book is that that it tells of a great act of vengeance in an utterly unrepentant manner. The narrator doesn't in any sense think that vengeance is bad. And he's not Christian, there are lots of, he's not religious, and so there isn't, he isn't in a world where he has a rule that he's not following. And the figures who are really influential for the couple are the old one and the wise one. And they are, that is, the educating figures in the lives of the protagonists. They believe in vengeance, a kind of measured vengeance. Or they don't say, well, vengeance is sinful, or it's not my province. And so, indeed, you could say, well, what's wrong with vengeance? The whole world is blind. You know, an eye for an eye for an eye, that obviously it never ends. You have vendetta cycles that last centuries. Violence doesn't end violence. It just perpetuates it. That's, you know, that's a strong argument. You can look around in a society and ask if there's vengeance and who meets it out. And so, indeed, it seems to me that that just sort of occurred to me when I was speaking with McSweeney's, but that essentially a state, you know, the state has a monopoly on vengeance. It is avenging wrongs to the state. You commit treason, you would be sentenced like Ezra Pound was, to death.
Right, and they call it justice, in quotes.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, the Pound case is complex. So uh-huh. I'm not, Pound did some things that you should definitely, I don't even want to get into the Pound case, but I certainly don't, I don't say that to speak of him as a martyr, but I only say that vengeance is the exclusive province of power in the society. It could be the power of the church, it could be the power of the state, but Hannah and the narrator are anarchists in that regard. They think that they might, if there is to be vengeance, they can mete it out.
Oh, I think the reader, at least in my case, felt it was justified in this instance. And I think that was the spark behind McSweeney's question was, do you ever feel vengeance is justified, as it appears to be in Hannah versus the Tree?
Yeah, I guess we're obliged to this moral statement, which is that it may be natural, but it's bad for society because it introduces or perpetuates violence. It is essentially the perpetuation of violence.
It's not a resolution. I read a lot about Buddhist texts, and they make it very clear that revenge is not the way to go. It's compassion and love is really the only answer.
There is, however, an animal logic to things, and that's perhaps why animals play the role that they do, which is that certain big noises, certain large responses from animals, they're not so much vengeance as ending a problem, taking violence into their own hands, being lethal, and not having a problem with that. And so there's one element of avenging oneself, and the other is being lethal, because there's someone who has to die, at least one person who has to die, and that is just about their sense of justice. That person shouldn't be in the world anymore. They're dangerous. They're a danger that should be removed. And they have no moral compunction about that whatsoever.
And that actually is clear from the end when we hear from the narrator about Hannah's response to her act of vengeance and the resolution of it. It's not something that gives her a thirst for blood, for further blood. She's kind of happy with with the results. Now, given the mythical and historical references, the plot of the novel is still very contemporary. Her plan for vengeance on her family includes drug dealing, marijuana, cocaine, cryptocurrency, and computer hacking. So you made this a very contemporary epic, I'm sure by design.
Yeah. Oh, I should just a tiny precision. She doesn't deal cocaine. She refuses to deal cocaine. But yeah, they need money. And they need money that, though her family's quite wealthy, that her family can't see her amass. And so she does deal weed.
And that she refers to as the silver that is required to carry out her plans for revenge. It funds her plan.
Yeah, exactly. Just as Hamilcar Barca, Hannibal's father, needed, if he was, so at the end of the first, Rome wins the first Punic War, narrowly, if you like, and there's an undefeated general who's the father of Hannibal. And that undefeated general goes to Spain outside of the reach of the Romans and of his own people, the Carthaginians. And he wants to launch or return to war with Rome and feels he can beat them. But he needs money. And so he finds silver, he mines it, and then he makes a huge army. He dies when Hannibal's young, and so Hannibal then takes over that dream and realizes it in some ways. But yeah, Hannah has to do something analogous. She needs funds to launch a real war. She's going to need to employ hackers who are expensive. She needs a certain level of malfeasance.
And she needs bitcoins to pay them, so it's kept secret.
Yeah.
But I just love the way the plot developed there from what appeared to be kind of an ancient epic of heroism to include these more contemporary elements. You did a reading in Portland last night at Mother Foucault's bookstore, which is our good KBOO friend and neighbor here. What was the audience reaction? I'm also interested, as you go around on your reading tours, were there any particular interactions with readers, people in the audience that stand out?
Yeah, so I've done two events this week. One 3 days ago in Los Angeles, and one last night at Mother Foucault's here in Portland, which was really lovely, beautiful bookstore, beautiful evening. The questions are all new to me. I'm going to be going on and doing some events in New York and in Boston, and Chicago, and D.C., a few other places maybe, and so perhaps I'll reach a point where I'll say, oh, yeah, I know that question, or I see where I've already thought through this. But this is a really enjoyable moment for me in that right now, talking with you, talking with readers last night at Mother Foucault's, talking with readers in Los Angeles at Stories a few days ago, that people would have questions about my book is surprising. And so I'm discovering a lot. I'm really satisfied by the understanding. I'm so happy to be understood. But there are a lot of questions. Last night, for example, there were a number of really beautiful questions, especially from Jesse Carver, who is moderating, about the feminism of the book or the role of the feminine in the book. And she was noting things that I hadn't even noticed. She's such a keen-sighted reader that all the really interesting characters are women. That is debatable because there are a few. The old one and the wise one are both quite interesting to me, male characters. But
and,
she's right.
Justin, I think, is an interesting character. Yeah. Not so much the narrator. But yeah, there's Hannah. Is it her cousin?
Yeah, Annika. So, for example, Jesse really was a fan, as am I, of Annika as an unusual, intense character. And so I've been struck by that. I've been people noticing as you have more clearly than anyone, but the epic nature of it, not in the sense that it's gigantic, it's a short book, but that it has epics or stories of heroes, and it's a story of a heroine. And the way that readers have responded to that have been very interesting for me. And lastly, the range of questions about craft. because I don't really, of course, know how anybody writes. I've read about lots of writers I love, and I've read about Nabokov writing on note cards, and I've seen Joyce writing in these little school exam books, and I've seen the materials, and I've heard the descriptions of the process. But it's really interesting to be asked about one's process, because one realizes aspects of it. Chiara Barzini, the writer, was asking me a question at the event or at an event about revision and how I moved through a mass of writing, how I knew, how I kept, and how I cut away. And those questions have been really fascinating for me. They're emotionally touching that someone would care how I made the thing. And it's interesting, of course, to talk to other makers about how they make, or Chiara's a writer, great writer, and more generally to hear what interests readers. I've been really touched and really surprised by everything.
Well, again, it's a great book, great story, and just so beautifully written. Leland, thanks very much for joining us today at KBOO.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Leland de la Durantaye, author of the new novel Hannah Versus the Tree from McSweeney's Press. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Leland for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.